Thank you. Thank you for the introduction to come talk here. It's been 6 years since I was here before. Graduated from PSI in 2013, and it's been really lovely to be back. In a way, it really feels like home. I would like to pose a basic question about quantum mechanics. That is, what does it mean for two quantum operators or operations to disagree with each other, and how should we measure how much they disagree with each other? You can ask these questions of two different types of quantum physicists. You'll get two different answers. On the one hand, you can ask someone in pure quantum information theory. And they would say something like, well, take your two operators, let's call them A and B, stick them in an uncertainty relation. If the right-hand side of the bound is large, then the operators disagree with each other quite a lot. By the way, from now on, I'm dropping hats from operators. On the other hand, you can ask someone at the intersection of condensed matter and high-energy physics, people who like thinking about black holes and holography, and they'll have a certain setting in mind. They'll think about some interacting quantum many-body system, like a chain of spins governed by some interesting non-integrable Hamiltonian. You can imagine injecting some information locally, maybe flipping the spin over here with some operator W. Then they think about the system evolving in time under its intrinsic Hamiltonian under some unitary evolution U. We're especially interested in unitaries generated by Hamiltonians that are very non-local, non-integrable. So that will cause this W to evolve to a W of T in the Heisenberg picture. And its support is going to spread across the system. It'll spread across the system through interesting many-body entanglement. So if at a later time we perform some local probe to try to get at the information that was initially injected, we can't recover it because it's now spread across the system. And we say that the information has scrambled. So information scrambles when this W of T hits the V, and then W of T and V don't agree with each other anymore. So we could go back to our initial question about some operators A and B. And we might assign A to W of T and assign B to V, and say, this is how we're going to approach our question in the context of this intersection of condensed matter and high energy physics. So again, we have these two operators that are disagreeing with each other, but that disagreement can lead to disagreement between the two types of quantum physicists who are disagreeing about what it means for operators to disagree. But we want peace on Earth. So we would like some way of reconciling these two different notions of operator disagreement. That's the task that I undertook with some co-authors in this paper. We derived an uncertainty relation for quantum information scrambling. It's an uncertainty bound that, or it has an uncertainty bound that tightens when the system scrambles across the system, showing that an uncertainty relation can reflect the same type of operator disagreement as quantum information scrambling. The key to this construction is a quasi-probability distribution. A quasi-probability is sort of like a probability, but it can exhibit non-classical behaviors as by going negative and non-real. I'll give some more background shortly. So here's where I'd like to go in the rest of this talk. I'll first give background about uncertainty relations, in particular entropic uncertainty relations. We're familiar from undergrad class with uncertainty relations cast in terms of standard deviations. For some reasons, those aren't entirely desirable. So the quantum information theory community has recast them in terms of entropies. Those are modern uncertainty relations. I'll overview those, then I'll give more background about quantum information scrambling. Then we'll put the two together in entropic uncertainty relations for scrambling. We can see, just by a physical reasoning and intuition, the form that these relations should have. From there, the proof is pretty simple once we have the intuition in place. Then I'll show that the bound does increase at the scrambling when the system is scrambled. So let's start with background about entropic uncertainty relations. And there are old-fashioned uncertainty relations that all of us are familiar with. Heisenberg was the first person, or as far as we know, the first person to intuit the idea of uncertainty. And his idea was made rigorous by Robertson, who formulated this uncertainty relation that we're familiar with. So on the left-hand side, we have a standard deviation. We imagine preparing some P pure state psi, we can imagine measuring the operator A. Once we have that state, we'll get some outcome, some eigenvalue, little a. And we perform this in many trials, we perform this protocol in many trials, we'll get a spread of outcomes, little a. The standard deviation is this over here. On the right-hand side, we have a commutator evaluated in an expectation value of that same state. So it's a fairly simple construction, but it's not entirely what we want. First of all, the bound depends on a quantum state, but we're looking for a measure of just how much two operators disagree. And depending on which state you choose, that right-hand side can look very, very different. Also, the variances depend on the eigenvalues of our operators, but we could just relabel our dial, change the eigenvalues of the operators, and the uncertainty relation will look quite different. The values in it will look quite different. But all we've done is relabel our dial. So did we really change the fundamental disagreement properties of our operators? Finally, standard deviations certainly have very well-defined operational meanings, but there are functions that might be even more useful in some contexts. Uncertainty relations are useful in quantum information and communication applications like cryptography. And in quantum information processing, we can very often usefully express the optimal efficiency with which we can perform some information processing task in terms of an entropy. So it makes sense to put this workhorse of information theory, the entropy, into an uncertainty relation. That's why uncertainty relations have been recast recently, and over the past several decades. But the modern uncertainty relations are cast in terms of entropies. Here is a very famous example of an entropic uncertainty relation. It's called the Mawson-Ufink relation. On the left-hand side, we have two entropies, h of a and h of b. They're defined as follows. So a has some eigenvalue decomposition, which I put here. So consider preparing any quantum state. So there is a quantum state on the left-hand side of our inequality, not on the right-hand side, so not on the uncertainty bound, which is what we desired. And what's more, this uncertainty relation holds for arbitrary quantum states in the left-hand side. So suppose we prepare a quantum state rho, and we measure our operator A. Then we'll have this probability of getting outcome little a. From those probabilities, we can construct the Shannon entropy. So that's the h of a up there. And as we all know, since this is a quantum information theory group, the Shannon entropy, or entropies in general, quantify uncertainty about outcomes of measurements. And they do have a lot of use as the optimal efficiencies with which we can perform information processing tasks like data compression. So we've defined h of a, and h of b is defined analogously. On the right-hand side, we have this number c. Let's define that. C is called the maximum overlap. It has this definition. But suppose that we prepare some state b, and then we measure the operator A, and we try to guess the outcome. We'll guess that there's some outcome little a. This is the probability that we guess correctly. And suppose that we choose B and we choose our little a so that we give ourselves the greatest possible probability of guessing correctly. That is the significance of this maximum overlap. What's more, this maximum overlap, again, does not depend on the eigenvalues, and it doesn't depend on any quantum state. It just depends on the eigenstates of these two observables. We can understand this uncertainty relation by going through a simple example. So let's have in mind a qubit. Let's choose for our observable A to be sigma z, and let's choose for the observable B to be sigma x. Let's start with the maximum overlap on the right-hand side. For any eigenvalue of z, any eigenstate of z, and any eigenstate of x, this equality holds. That means that we have two operators that have mutually unbiased eigenbases. So it doesn't matter which z eigenstate you prepare, you never have any idea which x outcome you will obtain. In this sense, quantum information people say that sigma X and sigma Z fail maximally to disagree. What's more, this mutually unbiased Bayes property ensures that this maximum overlap is small. For instance, consider the opposite extreme. Suppose that we chose for the operator A to equal the operator B. Then if we prepared an, so suppose that A equaled sigma Z and also B equals sigma Z. If we prepared an eigenstate of sigma Z and we measured sigma Z, we would know the outcome exactly. So the maximum overlap would be 1. It would be very large if we could predict the outcome exactly. So this maximum overlap is quite small because sigma X and sigma Z disagree a great deal. Since the maximum overlap is small, the negative log of the maximum overlap is big. And so the right-hand side is big, as we should expect, because we know X disagrees with Z. That's the right-hand side. Let's move to the left-hand side. Again, the left-hand side can be evaluated on any qubit states. Let's try to design some qubit state. Let us choose, for instance, a qubit state that would make the bound as, or let's try to make the bound tight. Suppose that we choose a state that minimizes one of the entropies. For instance, we could choose for our initial state to be an eigenstate of Z. Then we would have no uncertainty at all about what the outcome of a Z measurement would be, so that entropy would be 0. But on the other hand, we would have no idea which outcome would obtain if we measured sigma X. So this entropy would be maximized. So if we set one entropy to 0, the other entropy is going to be big. So the left-hand side is going to be big, as the right-hand side is, so the bound checks out. But that's some background about entropic uncertainty relations. Let's move to the other camp, that is quantum information scrambling from condensed matter and high-energy physics. Again, we want to have in mind some quantum many-body system. So people on the high-energy side like to have in mind the boundary dual of a black hole, thinking about ADS-CFT correspondence, black hole information paradox, and how maybe space-time or time could emerge from entanglement. Another example that I find relatively simple to think about is that of a chain of qubits. So let's keep this in mind as an example. Let's label the qubits from 1 to n. We're going to subject this spin chain to a Hamiltonian, where the Hamiltonian will couple the subsystems together, and we're especially interested in Hamiltonians that couple spins together across distances as far apart as possible and that are non-integrable and have strong couplings. So this Hamiltonian generates a unitary operator, and we'll also have in mind some state of the spin chain. In many applications, people are interested in thermal states, but what I'm going to talk about holds for arbitrary states. The measure that we're going to find to quantify operator disagreement in this camp is defined in terms of two operators, W and V, that I mentioned briefly earlier. They're defined as Hermitian and or unitary. I need to keep in mind the simple example of Pauli operators that are localized on opposite ends of the spin chain, but in the results that I'm going to present, they're quite general, so you can think of W and V as Hermitian or unitary or both. For example, the W operator might be the Z component of the first spin, and the V operator might be the X component of the final spin. Noticeably, these two operators commute with each other, but again, in the Heisenberg picture, W spreads to a W of T, and eventually it's going to hit this side of the lattice and cease commuting with V, or cease to disagree with V. We say that information scrambles as the commutator between the two of them grows. So I say the commutator, but in fact, we're interested in a commutator magnitude squared. We're often interested in correlation functions generally. If we have just a commutator there, that commutator will die off relatively quickly in a way that I'll show. So it doesn't reflect interesting long-time physics because of some phase cancellations. If we put in the magnitude squared, then the phases can't cancel. So this will hang around and exhibit or signal interesting physics for a while longer, again, in a way that I'll show. So this commutator magnitude squared consists of two terms times two terms, which makes four terms total. And the most interesting term looks like this. So this I'll rewrite up here. It's called the out-of-time ordered correlator, which is a horrible number of syllables, so I'll occasionally refer to it as the OTOC. So I've written it, just rewritten what I had on the last slide up here. I'll rewrite the trace with this quantum state rho as the angle brackets over here. And I'll mention that people often denote this by f of t. So this is a signature of information scrambling, as well as all sorts of interesting things, quantum chaos, equilibration, and we can see easily why it's called the out-of-time ordered correlator. So we're going to step from right to left across this trace. That's like stepping from here to here. And I'll put the time parameter t along the y-axis. So we start off with this quantum state. It's not time evolved, so it's down here. We step a little bit leftward and we see this v, which is also not time evolved. But that w of t is time evolved, so it's up here. Then we see a v dagger down at time zero, then a w dagger of t up at time t. And this up and down motion is the reason for the name out of time ordered correlator. How does this thing behave? What does it do? We can plot it as a function of time. Now I have time along the x-axis, and I have the real part of the correlator along the y-axis. At early times, let's take the simple example in which v and w are unitary as well as Hermitian, or let's say they're at least unitary. Then at early times, well, w of t is practically just w, and w commutes with v. So we can take this w of t and commute it across the v dagger. Then we have a w dagger of t, w of t, which just cancels to the identity. We have a v dagger v, which cancels to the identity. So we have the trace of a quantum state, which is 1. So for a while, this correlator is hanging out about at 1, as we see here. But when w of t hits v, we see this drop. This drop happens around what's called the scrambling time. It's denoted by t star. That's when w of t and v cease to agree with each other. So someone in this intersection of condensed matter and high energy theory would say, aha, it's at this point that the operators disagree with each other. That is the measure that in this camp we use to diagnose disagreement. But you could ask, no, really, why are we using this funny-looking four-point function? Why not look at simpler correlators like a time-ordered correlator? We can measure these, and in the particularly interesting systems that are very highly non-locally coupled, these objects will change at a much earlier time, and then they'll about stay equilibrated. So if we just look at these simpler correlators, we'll think that after this early time, no interesting physics happens. But we see that it does by looking at the out-of-time ordered correlator. That's a reason to look at this funny object. So the out-of-time ordered correlator reflects a late stage of quantum equilibration, a particularly information theoretic, entanglement related stage, and a particularly subtle stage. It also, again, reflects something about quantum chaos, information scrambling, and the disagreement of two operators. Now we've given background about the two camps. On the one hand, uncertainty relations from quantum information theory, and on the other hand, the out-of-time ordered correlator from condensed matter and high-energy physics. We'd like to reconcile these two notions of operator disagreement. How can we do that? We could make a simple guess. We could say, let's take that simple Mawson-Ufink uncertainty relation, and let's make A equal to W of T, and let's set B equal to V. Unfortunately, the resulting uncertainty relation has no signatures of scrambling in it, so it doesn't reflect that second camp. But there's a clue here as to how to proceed.
Why not?
Well, you can look at the left-hand side, and you can look in the right-hand side, and they just won't change at the scrambling time, won't reflect scrambling. In the uncertainty relation that I'll present, you can look at the right-hand side, and it will reflect scrambling because of the way that we can design an uncertainty relation in a little more complicated manner. This entropic uncertainty relation that we saw replaced the Robertson uncertainty relation that contains one commutator. We said the out-of-time ordered correlator comes from a commutator magnitude squared. So what if we took the Mawson-Ufink relation over here and sort of squared or doubled the things in it, then maybe we would get something that would contain the out-of-time ordered correlator, let's say. But what it means to square or double each element in this relation over here is not at all clear. But let's try to reason loosely toward what might be a solution to this question. Let's start with the left-hand side. What does it mean to double or yes?
So the A and B here that you care about here is just WT and V0.
I'm just about to get to that. So at the moment, we've written this uncertainty relation with a quite general A and B, and we need to choose some operators or operations that would carry the flavor of the out-of-time ordered correlator into this uncertainty relation. So what if we took each of these operators and to double it, sort of replaced it with two operators? As was just pointed out, there are two operators associated with the out-of-time ordered correlator, WT and V. So we might think of squaring the single operator A by turning it into WT times V. Then we need a form for B, and A has to not equal B, but we have only these two operators from the out-of-time ordered correlator. So let's flip them around, or maybe take that product, WTV, and time reverse it. That's actually in the spirit of the out-of-time ordered correlator, time reversal. So let's have these ideas in mind. This way of thinking, taking WTV and time, well, reversing the two of them, is actually very much in the spirit of the out-of-time ordered correlator's connection to chaos. I don't have time to talk about that now, but if anyone's interested, I'd be happy to talk about that at the end of the seminar. Now, you should object that we saw, when talking about the ordinary Mawson-Ufink relation, what each of these entropies means in terms of just a measurement of A. And now if A is replaced with two operators, how to measure this product of operators is not clear. This product of operators is not Hermitian. So you should have this objection in mind. I agree with you. Just let's try this for now. Maybe shortly we'll see an idea as to how it could be natural for us to think of measuring this product of operators. Okay, let's push forward to the right-hand side of our uncertainty relation. We saw that the right-hand side contains a product of two inner products. If we want to double or square everything in this uncertainty relation, we should make that into a product of four inner products. Now, it just so happens that it is known that a product of four inner products naturally describes the out-of-time ordered correlator and information scrambling. Now, to motivate the definition of that product of four outer products, I'm going to take the out-of-time ordered correlator and decompose it in a certain way. Here's the definition of the correlator. We said that V and W are Hermitian and or unitary, but each one has an eigendecomposition. We can replace V. We might think like so, where the little v's are eigenvalues, but in fact, the operator V is highly degenerate because it's, for example, just a Pauli operator acting on one spin. But our chain consists of a whole lot of spins. So this Pauli operator has only two eigenvalues, but the Hilbert space is 2^n dimensional. So there's a lot of degeneracy in here. So let's shift from this way of thinking to an eigenvalue decomposition where this is the projector onto the whole little v eigenspace of the operator big V. Let me tweak this one more time. Let me change notation from little v to little v sub 1. So if big V is a Pauli operator, V1 equals plus 1 or minus 1. V1 is just a label. I'll eigendecompose V dagger in the same way. I'll call the eigenvalues V2 star. The star is here because of that dagger. We can also eigendecompose W of T. I'll call the eigenvalues W1, and I'll call these eigenvalues W2 star. We substitute in these eigenvalue decompositions. We take the sums and the eigenvalues, and we push them out to the left-hand side of the trace because the trace is linear. We get the out-of-time ordered correlator equaling a sum over a bunch of eigenvalues, of some bunch of eigenvalues, times a trace. The trace has four projectors and a quantum state. That trace, or again, think of each of these projectors as a generalization of one outer product, like V1, V1. And we see that this trace is really a generalization of an outer product, or excuse me, a product of four inner products. That is exactly what we were looking for the right-hand side of our uncertainty relation.
So just checking, so the eigenvalues of, like the eigenvalues don't change under the unitary dynamics, so you have different labels just for convenience, I guess, no? Or, so
I agree that the eigenvalues don't change under the unitary evolution.
So V1 and V2 are, like the sums over the one and two indices are over the same set?
Correct. But we have to give the eigenvalues different labels because there are two different sums in there. Yeah, that's all. That's all, yeah.
Sorry, I got confused. So V was some operator with some eigenbases, and are you still assuming V is like a Pauli operator, or you are...
This is not specific to Pauli operators.
Just decomposing V into this form.
Exactly. So this trace is a very funny looking object. What to make of it is not at all clear. So let's see if we can reason our way toward understanding it. It is a quasi-probability distribution, or it's an element of a quasi-probability distribution. So let me give a little bit of background about quasi-probability distributions. I know some people in Waterloo think about them a lot, and some people in Waterloo think about them not at all. So quasi-probability distributions are used in mostly quantum optics, quantum foundations, and quantum computation. They're the quantum versions of phase-based densities. Suppose that we want to represent the state of a classical statistical mechanical system. And we'll choose some conjugate variables, Q and P, we draw these phase space axes, and we represent the state of the system with a probability density, a phase-based density. We might want to represent the state of a quantum state the same way. We almost can, but we have to give something up, namely at least one axiom of probability theory. We know that probabilities are real, they're not negative, they sum to one, they compose in certain ways. Relaxing different axioms can lead to different quasi-probability representations of a quantum state. When I say a representation of quantum state, I mean a function of variables like this that we can use to calculate probabilities and expectation values. For instance, who here has used the Wigner function? Yeah. Most people are fairly familiar with the Wigner function. It is probably the most famous quasi-probability distribution. Famously, it also goes negative under certain conditions that can signal non-classical physics. And a lot of very great work on Wigner functions and other quasi-probability distributions and their connection with non-classicality has come out of Waterloo. I call this trace the quasi-probability behind the out-of-time ordered correlator, because the correlator decomposes in terms of this distribution. For those who are experts on quasi-probability distributions, there is a cousin of the Wigner function called the Kirkwood-Dirac quasi-probability distribution. Some colleagues and I were motivated to extend or generalize the definition of that quasi-probability distribution, this is encompassed in this generalized Kirkwood-Dirac formalism. So this was originally discovered in that paper up there. And this paper is basically a biography of the quasi-probability behind the out-of-time ordered correlator. We arrived at this equation for the out-of-time ordered correlator. Now we can understand it better. It means that the out-of-time ordered correlator is an average over a quasi-probability distribution. So this average is just one coarse-grained number. The quasi-probability distribution itself is a whole list of numbers that contains more information. And over the past few years, I've spent a while finding theoretical and experimental applications of that quasi-probability distribution. I've had the great fortune to work with a lot of really wonderful collaborators, so I'd like to acknowledge them here. Also, if you are interested in this quasi-probability distribution, you can come to my next talk at the Perimeter Institute. It's going to be Tuesday later than this time, I was just informed, but back here in this room, focused on this quasi-probability distribution. Today I'm talking about one of its applications to abstract theory, to quantum information theory. Here I'll talk about applications to experiments and different aspects of theory. Also, some people in the Quantum Foundations group expressed interest in this paper. If you are interested in learning about it, feel free to shoot me an email. If enough people are interested, I'd be happy to give a chalk talk about it in case that would be helpful to people. Because it's about contextuality, which is part of the bedrock of quantum foundations at Perimeter. So, this quasi-probability behind the out-of-time ordered correlator, I should add, usefully can be measured experimentally with weak measurements. These are measurements that don't disturb the quantum system very much. If anyone is interested, then during the Q&A, I would be happy to talk about more about what a weak measurement is and what formalism we use to describe it. We implement a weak measurement by taking our system and coupling it to a detector, then measuring the detector projectively. This coupling we usually think of when we talk about measurements as creating a complete correlation, maybe entangling the two systems maximally. But that coupling is implemented with some coupling constant g, and we can choose for g to be a lot smaller than the natural energy scales of the other Hamiltonians in the problem. If g is small in this way, then the coupling is weak. People say that, particularly experimentalists who have performed weak measurements and then written papers about them, that they use weak measurements to sort of measure non-Hermitian products of operators. Basically, what happens is you have a product of two operators. You measure one of them weakly and you measure the other strongly. And you can infer from the outcome statistics a certain expectation value of that operator product. That should give us an idea. We saw earlier that it would make some sense to think of the left-hand side of this uncertainty relation that we're reasoning our way to as containing products of two operators. Now we can see how to operationalize that idea. We should think of, in this case, measuring V weakly and then measuring W of T strongly. So where has this clue that led us on this journey led us? We should conjecture that you can reconcile these two notions of operator disagreements, uncertainty relations, and quantum information scrambling as follows. We should conjecture that there exists some uncertainty, entropic uncertainty relation, such that we can replace this A with a W of T V and replace this B with the time reverse. We operationalize these two using weak measurements. And this right-hand side is going to contain this trace with a product of, well, this trace that is a generalization of a product of four inner products, this quasi-probability behind the out-of-time ordered correlator. That term in the right-hand side, well, it carries all of the information that the out-of-time ordered correlator itself contains, and we know that the correlator changes interestingly at the scrambling time, so this quasi-probability distribution this quasi-probability distribution must change at the scrambling time, so that's what's going to let the bound reflect scrambling. So this uncertainty relation will reflect the same operator disagreement as the out-of-time ordered correlator. So can we prove this relation that we are conjecturing? Yes, of course, that is why I'm giving a seminar. The proof is fairly easy once we have the physical intuition in place. First, we find a generalized uncertainty relation. I showed you the Mawson-Ufink relation. That's defined in terms of a measurement of an observable A and a measurement of an observable B. We're looking for more general quantum operations, more general measurements than just a strong measurement of an observable. So we should look in particular for entropic uncertainty relations for POVMs, positive operator valued measures. Fortunately, people have proved such general relations, but we can take one of these results and figure out what are the right POVMs on which to evaluate this generalized uncertainty relation. We need to pick the right POVMs to reflect scrambling. As we saw earlier, one of the POVMs should be sort of like a product of WT and V. In fact, we replace this A with a weak measurement of V followed by a strong measurement of WT. And the B POVM will be just the time reverse, which again is related to the out of time ordered correlator's connection to chaos, which I haven't explained, but which I would be happy to explain. Then we take our POVMs. Those give us, those determine what the right-hand side of the uncertainty bound is. We substitute in and we evaluate the right-hand side. Unfortunately, that right-hand side is not easily experimentally accessible. But we can bound the right-hand side in terms of quantities that are experimentally accessible with weak measurements. So mathematically, what we use is expansions in this weak coupling constant G, monotonicity of the Schott and P norm. So it took some thought, but it's fairly straightforward. We end up with this entropic uncertainty relation for quantum information scrambling. It has this form. It has these two entropies associated with, they quantify the uncertainty about the outcome of the two generalized measurements that I described. That's on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we have the weak coupling strength times some classical factor. It's not interesting. It basically just contains probabilities. Then we have this second order term times a factor that contains the out-of-time order correlator's quasi-probability distribution. That's the term of interest. Then there are some higher order terms that we can ignore. It's this quasi-probability factor that changes at the scrambling time that will enable the bound to strengthen at the scrambling time so that the uncertainty relation reflects the same operator disagreement as scrambling, as the out-of-time ordered correlator. But let's see that this bound does strengthen.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
So the classical factor, so if the system doesn't scramble at all, then the second term is completely missing?
The second term will just about stay at the same value, and it's never going to cause the bound to increase.
I see. Is there any way to get rid of the classical factor somehow, or is there any intuition about this first term?
So one intuition about the first term versus the second term is the following. So the out-of-time ordered correlator and its quasi-probability can be measured with weak measurements in a way that I'll show next week. So you run a circuit, it involves some weak measurements and a strong measurement, and then you process your measurement statistics, and you infer the value of the correlator or the quasi-probability distribution from a term that's of relatively high order in the coupling constants. And in general, when you infer these quasi-probability distributions of this sort, you ignore the highest order terms, and you ignore the lowest order terms, the biggest terms. And what you're really interested in is a term that multiplies a g squared or a g cubed or a g to the fourth. And that's because this out-of-time ordered correlator is a four-point function, because it is this complicated object. So it would make sense for a higher order or a many-point function to be multiplied by, to be in a higher order term. Yeah, that's the intuition behind it, yes.
The most general lower bound is dependent on the size of the operators, right? So how should we understand the relations between this and the most general entropic uncertainty relation?
What do you mean when you say the most general entropic uncertainty relation?
Some bound like minus log D or something like that, which is dependent on the size of the operators.
So what we did was we took an entropic uncertainty relation that is quite general for arbitrary POVMs, and we substituted into it for POVMs that are well suited to out-of-time ordered correlators and scrambling. So you could try to take this generalized uncertainty relation that we took from the literature and try to tighten it in some way. That would be pure quantum information theory as opposed to quantum information plus scrambling. Then you could show us that uncertainty relation and we could see if we could play the same game with it. Basically, we wanted to create to derive an entropic uncertainty relation, any entropic uncertainty relation that reflects information scrambling, so that we could bridge these two different camps. It might be true that there could exist other forms of uncertainty relations, so that you could substitute, you could figure out how to take those and substitute in for operators that would get you a total uncertainty relation that would reflect scrambling. That would probably require a similar construction process to the one that we walked through in terms of general intuition.
Ask one more question.
Yeah.
The second term, so it starts from zero at the beginning? Or?
I'll show it on the next slide. Yeah. So on the slide, I'll show that we performed some numerical simulations with a spin chain to see that what I was describing really is borne out. We simulated a chain of 8 qubits, and our Hamiltonian was a power law quantum easing model. That means that there was a ZZ interaction between spins, and as this spin interacts with spins farther and farther away, the interaction strength decays with the power law. We chose for our out-of-time ordered correlator to be defined in terms of the Z component of the first spin and the Z component of the final spin, but the results don't depend very much on which particular W and V we chose. So these are the results. We should focus in particular on this green line. This shows the right-hand side of the uncertainty relation, namely the bound. You can also look at the out-of-time ordered correlator or at the quasi-probability distribution. Either of those will tell you that the scrambling time is here. So we see in this green line that the bound does rise at the scrambling time, and that's because of, as we see from this orange line, it's because of the terms that are proportional to g squared, namely the terms that contain the out-of-time ordered correlator's quasi-probability distribution. So the uncertainty bound does strengthen at the scrambling time, showing that there is an uncertainty relation that reflects the same operator disagreement as scrambling in the out-of-time ordered correlator. And we can understand that that happens because we designed our uncertainty relation, so there's a quasi-probability in the right-hand side. In summary, we have reconciled these two different notions of quantum operator disagreements. What can we do next? There are a number of things possible. First, we can explore this relation experimentally. Everything, all of the operations that define it can be implemented experimentally, including with technology that we have today. The out-of-time ordered correlator and its quasi-probability can be measured with weak measurements. The prescription was given in these two papers, and I'll walk through a circuit of how you measure these objects with weak measurements in my talk next week. This looks viable for a number of platforms, especially superconducting qubits, and we've done a fair amount of work modeling superconducting qubits, implementing these measurements, but also quantum dots, trapped ions, maybe NMR, and ultra-cooled atoms seem like viable platforms. Actually, some experimental work is being done on this. You can take our uncertainty relation and simplify it a great deal. You can do away with the scrambling. You can even do away with the many-body nature of the system. So you get basically just an entropic uncertainty relation for weak and strong measurements. Kader Murch over here is an experimentalist at Washington University in St. Louis. His lab has superconducting qubits. They perform weak measurements. So his lab is now looking into that simplified entropic uncertainty relation experimentally. On the theoretical side also, there are a couple of opportunities. First, a quasi-probability can be non-classical, as I said, by having negative or non-real values. I should add, the out-of-time ordered correlator's quasi-probability has an extra degree of freedom relative to the Wigner function. It can also be non-real. We can ask, to what extent does that non-classicality contribute to maybe raising of the uncertainty bound, which is a different sort of non-classicality? Also, we were explicitly thinking about discrete systems because I like thinking about spin chains and Pauli operators, and also a lot of entropic uncertainty relations have been proved explicitly for discrete systems, but there's this condensed matter and high energy physics camp that likes to think about quantum field theories. So you can try to reformulate these uncertainty relations in that setting. Actually, A postdoc recently did this, so we're looking around for an interesting setting in which to evaluate or with which to illustrate this entropic uncertainty relation for scrambling in continuous variable systems. If anyone has any ideas, I'd be very glad to hear. In summary, we said that two different camps within quantum physics have different notions of what it means for two operators to disagree with each other or how we quantify that operator disagreement. In pure quantum information theory, we have people using uncertainty relations cast in terms of entropies. In the intersection of condensed matter and high energy physics, we have people thinking about quantum information scrambling as measured by out of time ordered correlators. We put these two notions together, showed that they can be reconciled by constructing entropic uncertainty relations for quantum information scrambling. We constructed these just by intuition and physical reasoning. The proof is pretty simple thereafter. We did some numerical simulations to show that the expected behavior of an increase of the bound at the scrambling time is realized. And we found that you can operationalize this abstract result experimentally. So thank you for your attention. Questions, comments, insults? Yes.
So I have a question about this G constant. Because you said that there's like a bunch of terms in the expansion of the right hand side, no? And the interesting one is the second.
Mm-hmm.
But for the weak measurement to be weak, do you not need this G to be small?
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, the first one is the one you're gonna see when you do the measurement?
Yeah, I understand. So when you can go back to, okay, how did we even find a way to measure this out-of-time ordered correlator and its quasi-probability with weak measurements? There are experimentalists who, over the past several years, have been measuring what I mentioned earlier, Kirkwood-Dirac quasi-probability distributions, which are not scrambling quasi-probability distributions, they're just ordinary quasi-probability distributions. They're measured with weak measurements. So what an experimentalist will do is prepare states, perform a weak measurement, perform a strong measurement, do that in a whole bunch of trials, and or two weak measurements even, and then a strong measurement. Do that in a whole bunch of trials, process the statistics. They want to infer the value of a quasi-probability element. So they will infer that from a higher order term in their data. So they basically say, we know that there are bigger terms in our data, but we can get them, they're just probabilities. So we can just get them by running strong measurement experiments, and then we subtract them off. So we sort of zero them out, and that's how they infer these higher order terms. So the higher order terms, I agree, can be outshouted by the larger terms, but we can zero them out. They're not very important. A lot of questions over there. Okay.
Sorry, just a follow-up on the question. So you did the expansion in G, but in your numerical results, the first term and the second term are of the same order. So does that mean that this expansion is not working in that case?
We did check to make sure that our Taylor approximation would hold, because we actually played with the idea of what if you do increase the coupling, what happens to the Taylor approximation, what happens to the right-hand side of the bound. So in this case, it did check out. As to the exact values of G and so on, I could look into this. There are a lot of factors that affect what are the exact sizes of all of the terms. For instance, what operators are we choosing? What is the value of G? What is the value of the system size? And if you're interested afterward, I could go through some of the parameter values and try to see, answer why it looks like these two are close together. But at least one, it's definitely smaller than the other. Let's see, so we have the terms proportional to G are of order 0.1, and the terms proportional to G squared are of order, So they go up to about 0.01. So at least on this part, they are of a different order of magnitude. And it's really after scrambling that we expect the uncertainty bound, the uncertainty relation to tell us something interesting anyway. So it looks like there might be about of an order of magnitude apart or so.
This plot includes the G factors or no?
Those are incorporated in here.
You have to take the higher orders into account, like G to the...
I'm sorry, I can't hear.
You have to take into account the higher orders, like G to the power 3.
No, because they're going to make much smaller perturbations, and that's also what's done in these experiments that I mentioned. The experimentalists will explicitly ignore the higher order terms. I saw questions over here in the back.
I was just wondering if there was a particular reason you used this non-local Hamiltonian.
This, you mean the power law quantum easing model?
Yeah, like,
yes.
Was there a reason you chose that over just nearest neighbor interactions?
Yes. And we also looked at nearest neighbor interactions, and that's fine too. In fact, in the paper that I said is the biography of the quasi-probability behind the out-of-time ordered correlator, we were using a nearest neighbor interaction Hamiltonian. That's fine. It's sort of the fruit fly of condensed matter, simple tests of these out-of-time ordered correlator matters. But as I said, the out-of-time ordered correlator is especially interesting in systems where there are very non-local interactions, even all-to-all interactions, like in the Sachdev-Yekutiev model. So the idea is, if you're studying the out-of-time ordered correlator, then in many cases, the more non-local the interactions, the better. And this power law quantum easing model is sort of an approximation to an all-to-all interaction. It's on its way there. But it is numerically tractable. And fairly simple to do numerically. Yes?
So in the construction, you mentioned in passing that you take some general uncertainty relation, and then on the right-hand side, you bound somehow to extract the outdog out of that. So if you had the Taylor series in full, like for all orders, would that correspond to the general bound?
Or
yeah.
Is it already...
Okay. So what happened was we had our general entropic uncertainty relation. We chose POVMs that we felt would probably get us a signature of scrambling in the right-hand side. So that we plugged for those POVMs into the right-hand side. And you can calculate the right-hand side. It's just you can't really access that experimentally in any clear way that we could see. So the right-hand side is already bound. So we just bounded it again in terms of quantities that we knew could be measured experimentally. But you could just go back to this experimentally, as far as we know, inaccessible expression, and it would be reasonable. I mean, it would be true. The inequality would be true. It just would be less operational because it's not clear how to measure that.
But I guess numerically, you could still check whether it checks out with the scrambling time and...
You could do that. And actually, we, as I said, we were playing around with different parameter regimes. We sometimes asked, well, what would happen if the coupling were larger. And we designed our parameters in one instance. We designed our parameters to make this uncertainty relation as tight as we could get it. And that was in the stronger coupling regime. So the Taylor approximation did not work. And we just used that earlier bound. We said, basically, yeah, this isn't the most experimentally accessible, but we are doing numerics. Let's just calculate it to see how tight we can get the uncertainty relation. So you can definitely do that. Rob.
Question about the connection with the out-of-time order correlators and quantum chaos. It looks to me like it may be connected with a notion of chaotic dynamics that was proposed by Asher Perez. So in quantum theory, if you measure overlaps in terms of, you know, inner products, then, you know, a small difference in the initial pure quantum state is going to be preserved under any unitary evolution process. And Perez pointed out that classically, and he showed quantumly as well, you can have a different notion of sensitive dependence on initial conditions, which is if you change the parameters in the Hamiltonian a slight bit and evolve according to that, then and you'll see a big difference. And so it looks as if this thing might be considering, you know, you evolve by one Hamiltonian, now evolve back by another Hamiltonian, and look and see if it's the same.
That's like the Loefschmidt echo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I have slides about one motivation for thinking why the out-of-time ordered correlator is a signature of chaos. So I could go through that also for everyone in the room. We can also see how this is sort of in the spirit of the A and B that we chose in the uncertainty relation. So as Rob said, classical chaos is defined in terms of sensitivity to a perturbation in the initial conditions. So you can imagine having a double pendulum, starting it off with some position and some momentum, at least one of which is large, and then letting it swing. So it would follow some trajectory in phase space. Then you can imagine starting it off at a slightly different point in phase space and letting it swing. So it would follow a different trajectory. These two trajectories would diverge in some manner quantified with a Lyapunov type exponent, or a Lyapunov exponent. We would like to see that the out-of-time ordered correlator plays a role in a similar story. So we're going to construct two protocols that differ more or less in terms of a perturbation to the initial conditions. In the first protocol, let's have as a cartoon in our minds, again, the spin chain. We'll prepare a pure state psi. Then we'll give a little flick on the right-hand side with our V operator. Suppose, for the sake of this cartoon story, let's suppose that, again, V and W are unitary. Then we evolve the system forward in time, and we flick on the other side with the W operator. Then we reverse the flow of time because we are all powerful experimentalists. We can reverse the flow of time, you know, negate magnetic fields and so on. This is possible in some platforms. That prepares a state that I'll call psi prime. In our second protocol, we again start with the state psi, but this time we omit the initial flick with the V operator. We go straight to the time evolution. Then we flick on the left-hand side with a W operator. Then we reverse time, and only now do we flick with the V operator. That prepares a state that I'll call psi double prime. Then you want to see how much the final two states differ because of where you put this initial perturbation. So as Rob suggested, we should take the overlap of the states. The overlap, if you plug in, you'll find equals the magnitude of the out-of-time ordered correlator. And around the scrambling time, that decays in this fashion with a Lyapunov type exponent. So not exactly the Lyapunov exponent of classical chaos, but something similar. So yes, the out-of-time ordered correlator plays a role in a very similar story. And you can make a detailed comparison with the Loch-Schmidt echo.
So f of t is the out-of-time ordered correlator for V
yes.
and W?
Yes.
So and U factors out of that somehow?
U is in it. So U, we always put the U dagger together with the W and the U.
Just W of T. Right, so like U dagger W U just becomes W of T in the approach.
Yes. But, yeah, so in particular, we can recast these two protocols as protocol of V W of T and then the time reverse. So it's like this entire operation, VW of T, is like what we chose to be A, and then the time reverse, W of T then V, is like our B in the uncertainty relation. So this parallels that. And a lot of the work by, the Asher-Perez camp, the extended camp, including regarding weak measurements, is related to forward and backward flows of time, especially when they talk about weak measurements. So made some sense that this quasi-probability distribution and the weak measurements should come up in the out-of-time ordered correlator story.
Comment first, I think the Asher-Perez camp is very different from the Yukir-Aronov camp.
Sorry, yes, I was thinking of different A name, never mind.
but also this is a little bit different from the proposal that Perez made for
yes.
Fine chaos, because there he was really imagining perturbing parameters in the Hamiltonian.
And then
having that perturbed Hamiltonian for the whole duration of the time evolution.
Yes.
But here you're just doing a perturbation or not isolated in time.
Yes, it is a different construction.
Do you know who first proposed that as a measure of chaos in the quantum sphere? Because I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, as far as I know, it first came up in the 1960s in Condensed Matter by Larkin and Ovchinnikov.
In a discussion of quantum chaos?
Where is this connection with quantum chaos and the out of time order correlator made? That's, I guess, what I'm wondering about.
So I think Larkin and Ovchinnikov consider this quantity, well, kind of in the 60s or 70s, but long forgotten. And then there's a paper by Schenker and Stanford which considered the effect of perturbation in a two-sided black hole, which actually considered the out of time order correlator function. When they wrote this paper, they didn't know that they were computing auto. But later, Kitaev realized that they are computing auto because Alexei knew this old Russian paper. That's how.
Yeah, so this was originally invented in the 1960s. It just experienced a resurgence or first surgence of popularity a few years ago because of this connection between condensed matter and to some extent quantum information theory and high energy physics.
I guess let me ask my question in a slightly different way because I'm not positive you've answered it. What would be the first paper where, for example, a formula relating the OTOC to a Lyapunov type exponent arose? Like, were these early papers in the 60s already seeing Lyapunov type exponents and recognizing that as chaos, or did that come later?
They do have Lyapunov type, right, yes.
They do, okay.
Well, much more detailed studies of the Lyapunov type behavior were performed over the past few years, and very detailed studies of comparisons of this exponent with actual Lyapunov exponents and the various types of behaviors that you can see over here. So a lot more work has been done recently.
Previous work, like in 60s or 70s, it's more like a single body quantum mechanics, whereas in recent context, it's more many body interacting systems.
Anything else? Great. Thank you.